Okay, good morning, everybody. So let me just begin by slightly correcting what I said on Friday. I'm not quite sure I got all the indices right. And maybe the factor of half we had some doubts about, but I believe this is correct if I check the algebra properly. So basically, we started from this equation, which was metricity. Okay, and this is a tensor, so you can think of it as the metricity tensor. By the way, if you read Sean Carroll's book, it's kind of amusing. People try to hoodwink you into believing that this condition is kind of necessary, okay, by saying they call it this. If this condition is satisfied, we say that the metric is compatible with the connection, just by definition. Okay, and so then everywhere else they say, well, if the metric is compatible with the connection, it seems to imply it's a necessary condition. It's just a clever use of language, but actually has no bearing on the issue at all. So there are reasons why that's a nice condition, but we'll get to them in a moment. But you'll see the kind of justifications people give for this and for setting the torsion zero. Kind of weird. Yeah.
For example, a covariant derivative of some tensor, and can we up and rise indices in a nice way that we usually do with tensors?
Yes, but there will be correction terms due to the metricity. So you can, but you see, the point is that if the metric, let's say we do something like this. Okay, so if T is a tensor, then this looks like a tensor with one up and one downstairs index. And now the point is, well, that's fine, that's still true, it doesn't matter about metricity. Okay? And metricity is irrelevant to this. This is a good tensor, because G is a tensor and T is a tensor. But the point is that if I now come and take the covariant derivative of this, if metricity is true, then it will turn out this derivative just doesn't care about the g, basically. So you have a sort of, you do have a Leibniz rule for covariant derivatives, which means the derivative of a product is the sum of terms where you differentiate each piece in sequence. Okay? So this is equal to, this is just an identity. Okay, so that is just true by the way it actually works. You might wonder, you see, this is only two free indices. So you're going to get one positive connection plus gamma for this index and minus gamma for this. And no connection for the contracted index, because that isn't a free index. Over here, you're going to get two negative connections, because you've got two upstairs indices. And here you'll get two positive connection terms, right? And two of them will cancel. So you get four connection terms in this, but two of them will cancel just because one index goes up and one index goes down. So that's completely independent of metricity. But if you have metricity, then it turns out this term is zero. Okay? Because derivative of G with downstairs indices is zero. And then there's an identity, which is the derivative of G with an upstairs index, with two upstairs indices. What does that mean? Well, what you can prove is that this is minus G alpha gamma G beta delta, the derivative of G with downstairs indices. G gamma delta. We'll probably get to prove that later. But it's always true that if I differentiate the inverse of a matrix, this is like taking a matrix M and calculating dm is its derivative, all right? Or infinitesimal shift of m. But if I compute m inverse, then the derivative of m inverse is minus m inverse dm m inverse. And this you can prove, well, I can prove it actually. So if m inverse is 1, and I take d of that equation, I'm going to get dm m inverse plus m d of m inverse, right, equals 0, because d of 1 is 0. Differentiating 1, I have to get 0. And so from this, I can actually prove that formula. So d of m inverse, multiply by m inverse, take this to the left-hand side, is minus m inverse dm m inverse. OK? So if the derivative of g is 0, then the derivative of g inverse is also 0. And that means the terms like this are 0. So really, that's the only significance of the metricity, is it allows you to ignore derivatives of the metric.
Something in the Christoffel symbol, in the symmetric part of the connection, is the derivative indexes shouldn't be, the first one shouldn't be an alpha and the third one a gamma.
Sorry, what, which term are you worried about?
Yeah, the first and the third one.
This one?
No, in the
this next equation?
Yeah.
I'm just deriving this. This is a consequence of that equation.
Yeah, but I mean the indices are different.
No, this index is the same as that.
No, but in the equality, in the derivative of the metric.
Yeah. I see. Yeah, I actually do mean this. How did I write that down? good question. Thank you. Actually, that's correct. Yeah, you're right. Gamma beta alpha. You're right. I'm sorry. It's been
you
a tough.
You could have left it and just switched gamma alpha. And
it's been a tough weekend. Yeah, that one should be alpha, beta, gamma.
What about the third?
And the third one is switched alpha gamma.
Okay. Gamma, alpha, beta. Okay. Good. Okay. So just to go through this argument again, metricity, what I do is I take this formula in three different versions. I take this one, and then I take with indices beta, gamma, alpha, and then with indices gamma, alpha, beta, and I subtract the second one. And that's just a clever thing to do, which happens to work. And so this gives me the symmetric part of the connection, and plus two terms involving the anti-symmetric part of the connection, where I anti-symmetrize on the last two indices. And that's just the torsion. Okay, so this term here is by definition the torsion beta gamma alpha. Okay, and there's no factor of two in the definition. The torsion is not the anti-symmetric piece. It's actually the connection minus the connection with the indices reversed. So now this gives me the symmetric part of the connection equals this piece, which will give me the Christoffel symbol, plus two terms involving the torsion. Okay, so these are different equations. Now, the correct statement, which I should have made last time, is that if the torsion is totally anti-symmetric, okay, you see, the torsion, by definition, is anti-symmetric on the last two indices. But if it is anti-symmetric on the first two as well, then it is totally anti-symmetric. Because if I flip these two indices and get a minus sign, right, and then I flip those two indices, I get a minus sign, then flipping the first and the last will give me a plus sign, and then it is totally anti-symmetric. Okay, so if the torsion is totally anti-symmetric, then this term is zero, because this is symmetric on these first two indices, right? So if the torsion is totally anti-symmetric, then the Christoffel symbol, then the last term vanishes, and the Christoffel symbol with the now erased connection, symmetric part of the connection, and I'll raise the index, gamma is equal to this Christoffel symbol. Okay, so that's the correct condition for the connection to be given by the usual expression. And actually, it turns out that in, so it turns out that in supergravity, the connection is totally, the torsion is totally antisymmetric. It's a problem of having an intelligent building. Yeah.
Is that statement equivalent to saying the contortion is antisymmetric? Because if the contortion is antisymmetric, then you also get the equality.
No. If the torsion is antisymmetric, then these two terms cancel.
Right, but if the contortion...
And that means that the contortion is proportional to the torsion. That's all it means. And, of course, the torsion is totally antisymmetric, so the contortion is totally antisymmetric.
So yeah.
Okay, so if the torsion is totally antisymmetric, then, and the contortion equals minus a half times the torsion.
So would it be more general to say that the equality holds if the contortion is antisymmetric?
I'll leave it to you to figure that out. I'm not going to worry about it. Okay. So now we get on to another topic, which is, let me move that one up. Any questions about that? Anybody unclear? GD6. So we've got this curved space. We've got our picture of our manifold. And so that's our manifold M. And we've got these coordinate patches. Let's label one by x and the other by x prime. And then the points in the overlap are described by both x and x prime. And we're interested in some particle traveling through this manifold, like a particle traveling through space-time when we studied special relativity. And so the space-time curve, which is the trajectory of a particle, okay, can be described by either x mu of u or x prime mu of u. Okay, so what I'm to think of is that every point on this curve, right, it's really a point on the manifold, and to each point p, I associate some value of this parameter u. U is just a number that goes along the curve, like a clock that the particle is carrying. But just a number along that curve. And obviously, there are many ways of associating a number here. And the physical picture is that there's actually a line, in, there's a curve in space-time, and that's what we care about. We don't really care about the number that parameterizes this curve. That's just another coordinate. It's a coordinate in a one-dimensional space. And you should think about the particle trajectory as a one-dimensional manifold. And that's really what a particle world line is. And so we'll have, in general, coordinate patches along that. So you'll have different U coordinates for every choice of coordinates along the world line. So I'm just going to pick one. And as we go on, we'll see there are some nice choices for U. But at the moment, we leave it completely general. The tangent vector to the curve is just dx mu du. And we'll call that xi mu, or dx prime mu du, which we'll call xi prime mu. Okay, so depending on which coordinate patch we used, we describe the curve and its tangent with x and xi, or x prime and xi prime. But it's easy to see the relationship, okay, because x prime mu of x alpha u is the curve, right? That is the curve. Because x prime is some function, every x prime is some function of the x's. That's the coordinate transformation. And the x is a function of u. So that is the curve, where x prime of x is the coordinate transformation from, so this function here is the coordinate transformation from x to x prime. So that's the curve in the x prime coordinates. OK, so from this, we can work out what is xi prime mu. So I just take this function and differentiate it. And the chain rule tells me when I differentiate a function with respect to an argument, of an argument, I've got to first have the derivative of the argument, and then so basically, I just differentiate this with respect to u, and I get dx prime mu du, and that's equal to partial dx prime mu dx times dx du, and that's equal to dx prime alpha dx mu times xi mu. So obviously, xi mu, the tangent vector, is a vector. It transforms correctly, except I've got the indices wrong. Alpha xi alpha mu. OK, it transforms like a contravariant vector, i.e. xi mu is a contravariant. Now, let us think about some quantity. So now consider some vector, V alpha, some contravariant vector, which is defined on the manifold. And we're going to evaluate it along this curve. All right, so some, just some contravariant vector on a curve, i.e. some contravariant vector evaluated on the curve. Okay, eventually I'm going to, soon I will take this vector to be psi, but let me begin more generally by just imagining there's some vector here, V, defined on the manifold, and I'm going to differentiate it along the curve. So dV alpha du, I could take its derivative along the curve, but this is not a vector. Okay, the reason is that if I change coordinate systems, V has this dx prime dx factor in front of it, and that will depend on u, right? Because dx prime dx is also a function of u, and so I'll get some bad term in the transformation law. And so as usual, we have to cancel that. So we introduce a connection. So we define the absolute derivative also sometimes called the proper derivative along the curve. Capital D, V mu, du, is equal to little d plus a connection term. Okay, so I'm just doing the same thing as before, and you can check. Exercise, check that dv mu du is a contravariant vector. And then a definition, which is that if dv u du equals 0, we say that V mu is parallel transported along the curve X mu of U. So that's the definition of parallel transport. And it corresponds to what I was describing in pictures in previous lectures, that we think about V along this curve, and as we travel along the curve, we evaluate the V, and if the V does not change in this sense, if this derivative is zero, then we say V is parallel transported along the curve. And actually, this now we get some relationship with metricity. So if this is true, then the derivative of the length of V okay, so G mu V mu V nu is the length of V evaluated in this metric. Because at every point, remember, I could, this is a scalar, so it doesn't matter which coordinate system I use. It'll have the same value in every coordinate system. So we can always choose coordinates at some point so that G is eta. And then this would be the length squared of the vector as measured in Minkowski space. So it's a nice quantity in terms of the correspondence with with special relativistic physics. And the property is that you see, here I write ordinary derivative because this is a scalar. So the scalar doesn't need any connection. So this is a scalar. That's a coordinate scalar. But because of the, so this is equal to d by du of g mu nu because of the Leibniz rule plus g mu nu dv mu du v nu plus g mu nu v mu dv nu du. Okay, but the last two terms are zero because v is parallel transported. And if you have metricity, then this is zero. If the metricity is zero.
Yes.
Yep.
Should it be capital D where you have the scalar?
No.
Oh, it's small d becomes capital D.
Yeah, so for a scalar, let's go back to the fact, if I've got some scalar on a manifold, then the ordinary derivative is a vector, right? That does transform in the correct way because there's no transformation of phi. Remember, phi prime of x prime equals phi of x. So actually, we can say that this is the covariant derivative of a scalar. There are no connection symbols. There are no indices to contract. So what would you multiply the connection by? There's nothing to put there, okay? So the covariant derivative of a scalar is the ordinary derivative. And likewise, the absolute derivative of a scalar evaluated on the curve is just the ordinary derivative. Okay, so whenever you have this covariant derivative or this absolute derivative, the whole point of it is to add connection terms to make the whole thing a tensor. But you don't need to do that when you have a scalar. So as I was trying to explain before, you see this covariant derivative satisfies the Leibniz rule. So let's try and work it out on something like this, alpha v beta. Okay, so my claim is that the covariant derivative on this is just the ordinary derivative. G alpha beta V alpha V beta, because that's a scalar. But the other way to work it out is with the Leibniz rule. I differentiate the G and then the V and then the V, right? So it's also equal to D mu G alpha beta times V alpha V beta plus g alpha beta d mu v alpha d beta plus g alpha beta v alpha d mu v beta. So how can these two things possibly be equal to each other? Well, they are because this one has two connections with a minus sign, with a plus sign, because we have two indices upstairs. This has a connection with one connection with a minus sign because it has an index downstairs, and likewise this one, okay? And all the connections will cancel. So if you're faced with calculating something like this, you can just use the ordinary derivative and forget about the connections. Okay, and that's completely independent of metricity or torsion, or it's just the basic property of the connection. So again, if you're not sure about this, I would just advise you to work this out. Okay, work this out with the two connections, and this with the connections, this with the connections, and just check that those terms identically cancel. Right, so what we see is that if the metricity is zero, then you see, because because so what you know, what is the definition of this d by du on G? The definition of d by du on G mu nu is just the generalization of this definition, right, on a vector. So that means d G mu nu by du with two downstairs indices, gamma g dx du minus gamma g dx du. I won't bother with the indices. Okay, so there'll be two terms like that. But now just think about evaluating dg du. What does that mean? Well, I'm supposed to evaluate g at x of u. G is evaluated on the curve, right? So I differentiate this g with respect to x of u. And what I get is dx alpha du times g times d by dx alpha of g. How shall I write it? Evaluated at x equals x of u. Okay, so basically when I work this thing out, all I'm going to get is dx alpha du times the covariant derivative d alpha g mu nu. Okay, so the absolute derivative is just given by the tangent vector dotted in with the covariant derivative, and that is zero if the metricity vanishes. Okay, so you might say that's a reason to believe the metricity should be zero, is that if it wasn't zero, well, if I parallel transported a vector along a curve, the vector's length would change. Okay? And bearing in mind, in special relativity, there were certain vectors that were very important, like the four velocity of a particle. And the four velocity squared was minus one for a massive particle. And if, when I follow it through space-time, its length changes, okay, what is it? It's not a particle anymore. And so clearly, this metricity is somehow damaging the basic notion of a relativistic particle. And so it, from that point of view, it's quite reasonable to set the metricity equal to zero. Though, as I say, I mean, Friedel and Smolin and their collaborators have recently written these papers, and the basic hypothesis is that the metricity is not necessarily zero, and it turns out there's some other ideas in there as well, but it turns out that you can actually observationally probe that question. Okay, I'm going to leave these. Whoops. I have some other interesting notes for you, but I'll explain later what they are. Okay, so where are we? We have just defined parallel transport. And now we're ready to discuss geodesic curves. So we've got our curve, x mu of u. And the question is, how should we, what's the most natural curve? What's the straightest curve in a curved space? Okay? So the notion is, the geodesic by definition is the straightest curve you can write. So I've got my curve, and then at every point I have a tangent vector, okay, psi mu of u, which is dx mu du. And what conditions should I impose on psi mu if I want this curve to be as near as I can get to a straight? What's the definition of a straight line? So I'm going to impose some condition on that psi mu, and I want it to be independent of the coordinate system. Okay, so I'm going to impose some condition on the derivative of psi mu. And what should I insist that is? In general, be completely general. What's the most general thing you could think of that would make some sense? So I'm going along a curve. It points in this direction. And as I go along the curve, what should I insist of that?
Zero.
Pardon?
Well, zero.
Zero is one condition. It's a little too strong.
Proportional.
It just goes in the direction. Exactly right. You could say, well, as long as I keep going in that direction, I'm OK. All right? It's a straight line. So as long as the derivative of the tangent vector is in the direction of the tangent vector might get longer or shorter, but I'm still going in the right direction. OK, so that's the definition of a geodesic. Psi mu. For some lambda of u. OK, so that's the definition of a geodesic. So let's put that in. Definition of a geodesic curve. And if we write that out, it looks like this. D2x mu du squared plus gamma mu nu lambda dx nu du dx lambda du equals lambda of u dx mu du. So it's a second order differential equation. Now there's a clever trick you can use to simplify this equation. Which is to pick a parameterization of the curve called the affine parameterization. That means choose u. Actually, we're going to choose a new u, which is a function of the old u. So we pick some new parameterization of the curve such that, in fact, let me call it sigma of u to be a new parameterization. Such that the term on the right-hand side is zero, is canceled. OK, so that would be a simpler equation if we didn't have this lambda of u. OK, and the point is you can always pick a new parameterization of the curve such that that term on the right-hand side is zero. And the way you do it, so we have x mu of u, and we're going to choose x mu of sigma. And so we're going to describe the same curve with a coordinate sigma, where sigma is a function of u. So x mu of u is really x mu of sigma of u. OK? So this is a function of sigma, which is a function of u. And when I differentiate with respect to u, I'll get the derivative of x with respect to sigma times the derivative of sigma with respect to u. So I'll get, so dx mu du is equal to dx mu d sigma times d sigma du by the chain rule. So all we do is plug that into the equation. Okay, and what I get, so just plug this formula for dx du into there, differentiate by u again, I'm going to get the second derivative of sigma with respect to u. Then I'm going to get another derivative of x with respect to sigma times d sigma du. So if you work it out, you will get the following. D2 sigma du squared times dx mu d sigma plus d sigma du squared times d2x mu d sigma squared plus gamma mu mu lambda dx mu d sigma dx lambda d sigma equals lambda of u d sigma du dx d sigma. Okay, so I just substituted in everywhere. In that second order differential equation, I substituted in this formula. Okay, so that's great, because what you can do is just use this term to cancel that term. Okay, and then you are left with this being zero. So actually, Houston and Todd has a tiny error here that you can solve this equation. You can solve d by du of d sigma du equals d sigma du equals lambda of u dx mu d sigma. Sorry, I don't need that term. Times d sigma du. Right, so if I want these terms to cancel, they both have this dx mu d sigma in it. So I just want this factor to equal that factor. But that's just an ordinary first order differential equation for d sigma du. Right? So d sigma du equals e to the integral lambda of u du integrated up to u. Okay, so you can always pick a parameterization, can always re-parameterize the curve. You can always re-parameterize the curve such that this stuff is zero. D2x mu d sigma squared plus gamma mu mu lambda dx mu d sigma dx lambda d sigma equals zero. Okay, so the correct statement about a geodesic equation is that in a particular parameterization called the affine parameterization, the equation looks like this. Okay, and sigma is the affine parameter along the curve. Okay, so in the affine parameterization, the quantity sigma is called the affine parameter, and it's unique up to, I don't want to write down here, oh, let me just move the board up. Whoops. Sigma is the affine parameter. It's not unique, but it's unique up to sigma goes to sigma prime is A sigma plus B with A and B constants. You see, if I just shift sigma by a constant, it's not going to change d sigma at all. And if I rescale sigma, Well, this term has two powers of sigma, and that also has two powers of sigma, so they scale the same way. So I can rescale sigma, and the equation is invariant. And when you have a quantity that is invariant under this kind of, where the equation is invariant under this kind of transformation, we call the quantity an affine parameter. And so in this parameterization, okay, the tangent vector is parallel transported. Along the curve. And as we showed, that means that the length of the tangent vector doesn't change. Length squared of the tangent vector doesn't change. Okay, so at some point, if you want to see this really working, I do encourage you to work out the case of a sphere, right? A two-sphere. We solved for gamma the Christoffel symbol, at least the symmetric part, was equal to the Levi-Civita symbol. So this two-sphere, we have the metric, d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. Here's my two-sphere. And so I've got g theta equals 1, g phi phi is sine squared theta, and all the other components are 0. And now you can just go away and calculate what is this symbol, okay, for all indices. There are only two values of each index. So at worst, you've got 8 calculations to do. So work out all the components of the affine of this symbol, the Christoffel symbol. Sorry, I said Levi-Civita. I mean symbol, Christoffel. So just work those out, and now consider curves which are geodesics on the sphere. Okay, so the obvious curves on the two-sphere are great circles. These are special curves. They're the closest you can get to the straight line on a sphere. And check that the great circles are actually geodesics. And then you can, and once you've done that, then you'll see that this picture I gave you before, that if I have some vector and I transport it along this curve, it's going to be pointing into the board over there. But if I transport it over here, parallel transport it on this geodesic, and then transport it on another geodesic, it's going to be pointing in that direction. So you'll see that parallel transport depends on the curve you take. And that is a measure of the curvature of the space. So that's a very good exercise to do, to check that you're following what's going on. Did I lose the... Okay, so somehow that's a clue that curvature causes curvatures related to the difference between neighboring geodesics. Okay, so if I have a geodesic on some spacetime, it's a curve, but I can also always consider another curve which is nearby. And the question is, does this other curve remain, so they're both supposed to be parallel lines, right? Or as near as you can, they're both supposed to be straight lines. So imagine we set two straight lines in flat space, and we keep going. Well, they remain parallel forever, and the distance between them remains constant. But what happens in a curved space? If it's curved, then we expect these two initially parallel curves to maybe deviate. Okay. So in fact, that is the simplest way to see the Riemann curvature of a space, is that we consider geodesics on that space, and we ask for how they deviate from each other. Okay, so the idea is we've got our manifold, we've got some geodesic, x mu of sigma, and then we consider some neighboring geodesic, and this is going to be x mu plus delta x mu of sigma. So what I mean by that is I take again a geodesic, but now it's close to the original x mu, but it deviates by the quantity delta x mu. Okay, they're both geodesics, and this delta x mu you should think about as a little vector, which for each sigma points from the first curve to the point at the same value of sigma on the second curve. Okay, so as we run along, we're going to follow delta x mu of sigma and see what it does. And just thinking about this immediately leads us to the Riemann curvature. And probably this is how Riemann discovered it. So let's start with this curve. Okay, but now I want to have a second curve, I won't write out the arguments, but x mu plus delta x mu is a function of sigma, so x mu of sigma is just the same old x mu there, and the delta x mu is a function of sigma. And then I've got to work out my Christoffel symbols. But really there, or connection, I've got to work out my connection, but I have to evaluate it, it's a function of x, I have to work it out at the right x. Okay, so that's evaluated at x plus delta x. And then I'll have d by d sigma of x nu plus delta x nu, x nu plus delta x nu d by d sigma of x nu plus x lambda plus delta x lambda. Okay, so I'm just writing exactly the same equation, but with x replaced by x plus delta x. And I also want this to be zero. So the idea is just to take the difference between these two equations, and that'll give me an equation governing delta x. And I'll only work to first order in delta x. See here I have quantities delta x, d by d sigma of delta x, d by d sigma of delta x. So I'm going to drop those. So take the difference, and keep only terms of order delta x. So I just drop anything delta x squared. And the difference is quite simple. So this term minus that, I just lose the first term. So what I get is d2 by d sigma squared of delta x mu plus. Now here, I'll do a Taylor series of gamma. Okay, so at zeroth order, I get gamma of x, which will cancel with that term. And then at first order, I'm going to get this term, delta x rho d rho of gamma mu mu lambda. And because I've taken this at first order in delta x, I can drop all of the delta x's in those terms, because that would give me second order terms. And so now I have dx nu d lambda dx lambda, d sigma, dx lambda d sigma. And then I've got to take these terms. Actually, you should notice one thing, that in this geodesic deviation equation, only the symmetric part of the connection enters, right? So let's just write that down. NB, only the symmetric part of gamma enters. Because if there's an anti-symmetric part of gamma, then this term, its contribution would cancel in this term. So we can always treat the connection as symmetric in this equation, because only its symmetric part entered the equation originally. And so that means that these two terms with the delta x actually contribute the same amount. And so you get plus twice gamma nu, gamma mu nu lambda times d by d sigma. So in all subsequent equations, remember, gamma is really replaced by gamma alpha mu lambda. Okay, so I won't bother to write down the symmetrization, but you should just remember that. It's really the symmetric part of gamma. And here we have delta x nu d by d sigma of x lambda equals zero. So that's my equation for the deviation delta x. Right. And now I'm going to give you a problem to work out this afternoon. There's a nice lot of algebra, but the result is very beautiful, so it will justify all the hard work. Show that d2 delta x mu d tau squared, d sigma squared, right? And that, by definition, is d by d sigma, proper or absolute derivative, d delta x mu by d sigma plus gamma mu nu lambda delta x nu dx lambda d sigma. There's no capital D. Okay, so capital D by D sigma on delta x mu is this quantity. And then we take this derivative again, and we'll get D2 delta x mu D sigma squared plus a lot of stuff. Okay, I'll leave it to you to work out all this stuff. And what I want you to show is that equals the following term, R mu nu lambda rho delta x rho dx nu d alpha d sigma dx lambda d sigma where R mu nu lambda rho is equal to minus gamma mu nu lambda comma rho. Remember, this comma here means d by dx rho minus gamma mu nu rho comma lambda plus gamma okay, so all you've got to do here is you'll have to differentiate this gamma and use the fact that d by d sigma of gamma of x of sigma is equal to d gamma d sigma, d gamma dx alpha times dx alpha d sigma. So this derivative acting on the gamma will give you this kind of term with one derivative. And then you're also going to get terms from gamma, gamma, because this absolute derivative will give you a gamma. That will multiply this gamma, and so you'll get these gamma, gamma terms. And so this is the Riemann tensor. And obviously, it's a tensor. Okay, so whereas the connection is not a tensor, the Riemann tensor is constructed from derivatives of the connection and connection squared in just such a way as all the bad terms cancel. Okay, so it is a tensor. And it describes the curvature of the space.
Well, can I have one question?
Sure.
The final result has to be this Riemann tensor, but I don't see how the second derivative with respect to sigma will vary. Because you will only have this Riemann.
Yes. Tensor. So you see, I've got this term. There are two equations I can use. One is this term, which is the original curve. The other is this term. I know what the second derivatives are. So you must substitute in for the second derivatives in terms of this junk. Okay, put it all together, and you will get the Riemann curvature.
Is there any easy way to see what is the tensor?
Let me see. Is there an easy way? Not particularly easy, but let me try and argue as follows. I think you, there almost is. Okay. Remember, we showed you could all gammas defined well. The symmetric part of how can I say it? Okay, if we take torsion to be zero, this does not. If we take torsion to be zero, and remember, this gamma here is really the symmetric part of gamma. So if the torsion is zero, then gamma is this Christoffel symbol. And you'll remember we could always pick coordinates in which the first derivative of the metric was zero at a point. That means we can always pick coordinates in which the connection is zero at a point. All components of the connection are zero at a point. Okay? So if you pick those coordinates, then these terms are just zero. So when I evaluate the Riemann curvature, these terms are zero. So then you ask, well, what are these terms? Well, these involve not just the first derivative of the metric, but the second derivative, because gamma involves the first derivative. So basically, this is a term involving the second derivative of the metric. And so this will be things like, you know, g with some indices and two derivatives, g alpha beta with mu nu. So these are proportional to things like this. And now the question is, are these, is this combination a tensor? And so the reason it will fail, the reason it might fail is because of certain derivatives on the coordinate transformation, okay? But this combination is just such those cancel. So it's kind of, you can take a shortcut to see that, let me see. I think it's possible to take a shortcut to see that this combination is exactly the one.
Wouldn't it be easier if you lowered the mu index and then looked at this, the symmetry and anti-symmetry?
You can certainly do that. You see, if I pick...
You know that parts of gamma are tensors.
Parts of gamma.
Of the...
No.
I mean,
I don't think there's any part of it that's a tensor. The parts of the connection?
Yeah.
That's really not a tensor.
I mean, not the symmetric part of this.
Yeah, but that's... only the symmetric part comes into this formula. Yeah. So that's not going to help.
I think
the simple answer is I mean, you can just do it, work out the coordinate transformation. Remember, gamma prime is equal to gamma with the right factors for a tensor plus the second derivative factor. And that was the bad factor. But if I differentiate the gamma, I'm going to get third derivatives of the coordinate transformation. And those are... this is exactly designed to cancel all of those terms.
But what we do is that we choose a coordinate system in which gammas themselves in this point are zero.
Right.
Then we make additional transformation and look how this first part transforms.
Exactly.
But what about the second part? It will not be zero in the coordinate system to which we go.
No, that's why I believe there is a shortcut, but it's not completely obvious. There is an obvious way to do it, but you know you're welcome to try.
On the left-hand side of the equation is a tensor, so on the right-hand side must be a tensor as well. So in some sense, you can argue that everything you have on the right-hand side, you know about these things that they are tensors. So arguing you must be tensor as well.
That's yes, that's absolutely true. So you see this delta x mu. The thing you have to believe is that delta x mu is a tensor. Is a contravariant vector. Okay, that's because then the left-hand side will be a derivative of a contravariant vector. Actually, second derivative will still be a tensor. This is not totally obvious because the curve x mu is not a vector, right? X mu of sigma is definite. It has an index. That is not a contravariant vector. Why? Because when I change coordinate system, that goes to x prime mu of sigma. And that is not related to this by a factor of dx prime dx, right? So x is not a contravariant vector. But delta x is. Okay? And let me just see if I can... because delta x is the difference between... So, yeah, I'm not sure I can prove it off the top of my head, but the difference between two curves actually is a contravariant factor. Okay? I probably almost can prove it. Okay? Let's take x prime u of sigma. That's the curve in the primed coordinate system. And so, yes, so the point is the following. What is delta x prime? What is this difference in the primed coordinate system? Okay? So that is equal to delta of that is equal to dx prime dx of delta x. You see, we do have x prime of sigma. What is x prime of sigma? Well, x prime of sigma just means calculate the coordinate transformation, x prime u of x of sigma. Okay? This is what it means. X prime of sigma is x prime of x, the coordinate transformation from x to x prime, evaluated at the point sigma. So now I can vary this equation. I say, what is the delta x prime? Well, actually, when I vary x to x plus delta x, what I'll get is the partial derivative dx prime dx times delta x. Okay? So actually, delta x is a contravariant vector. And therefore, the left-hand side is a tensor, because we constructed it out of these covariant derivatives. Therefore, the right-hand side must be a tensor. We did our algebra correctly. This is a tensor, this is a tensor, that's a tensor, and so this must be a tensor. Okay, I think we are done. Are there any other questions? So you've got a lot of work to do. This is really a very involved calculation. Okay, but it is only one page, and I can give you the page tomorrow. Here it is. It's a complete calculation. But I do encourage you to do it for yourself because it's a really good exercise. Oh, I wanted to mention I've handed out some notes. Now, these are not really notes for the course, but they're interesting background reading. So only read this if you have time on your hands. But what's nice about it, it comes out of a book on path integrals by Kleinert, which is a great big book you'll find in the library. And I just put it in there because Kleinert comes at the whole question of curvature and torsion in particular from the point of view of solid state physics. So he has these nice pictures of a crystal lattice and dislocations. And so from his point of view, the curvature and the torsion are related to dislocations in the crystalline lattice. Okay, and it's interesting because, and I must admit I haven't read it in detail, but basically he has a whole take on what torsion is and the difference. The torsion is essentially the difference between the shortest path on a manifold and the straightest path. Okay, so if you he discusses this difference in terms of this these pictures. So I just give this to you as a kind of interesting thing to think about.
So did I just understand correctly that on manifold torsion, geodesics don't minimize length?
I'm not going to answer that question. But you're welcome to read in here. He discusses this.